from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this morning argues that Democrats and progressives need to stop talking down to the white working class.
Climate change progressives have framed as either you believe in climate change or you're a stupid, ignorant peasant who is a climate denier. That basically is the process of class cluelessness, class condescension.
That's UC Berkeley Law Professor Joan Williams, who says she has been trying since the election to get her fellow liberal elites to stop diminishing white working class voters as poor, racist, and uninformed. Coming up on Forum, we talk with Professor Williams about her new book, White Working Class: Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America. And that's next, after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The election of Donald Trump highlighted the deep divisions in the United States and focused attention on the concerns of white working class voters. Shortly after the election, UC Hastings Law Professor Joan Williams published a widely shared essay in the Harvard Business Review, now expanded into a book, that explores what she says are misconceptions of the white working class, including that they are poor. She joins us this hour to discuss her new book, White Working Class: Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America, and to offer some ideas for getting past the divide. And welcome, Joan Williams.
Delighted to be here. Thank you, Michael.
Glad to have you back. Let's just begin with semantics a little bit, because those of us who had any schooling with Marx and everything think of working class as proletarian, whether you believe in Marx or not, the lumpen and all the, which includes the poor often, as opposed to the petite bourgeois or whatever. You're talking really about kind of middle class more, aren't you?
But I am.
Working middle class people. Yeah.
The way I define actually I call them the missing middle. It's the bottom 30% of household incomes. Those are low income Americans, poor Americans. The top 15 to 20%, those are the elite. What I'm talking about is the middle 53% that we really should be calling the middle class, but they're being called the white working class or the working class.
This is $45,000 to $130,000 income roughly in that neighborhood. And this is also, these are the people who voted for Trump in droves, and they don't seem to have buyer remorse, at least at this point.
No, last time I looked, only 6% had buyer's remorse. 15% of Hillary voters had buyer's remorse.
Well, a lot of this has to do with really the attitudes, and you corner them in many ways, that this particular class of people has. First of all, where the poor are concerned, there's a lot of resentment because the poor, as far as they're concerned, get handouts and dole and, you know, subsidies and so forth that they don't get. In fact, about close to 29% of poor people get family child care, which that middle class that you talk about, working class as you call it, don't get. And it's also a group of people that really admire those who make a lot of money, like Trump.
Yeah, the white working class and the African American working class is a little different when it comes to their attitude towards the poor. Among African Americans, there's much more of a "there but for the grace of God go I" attitude towards the poor. But among white, these middle class Americans, we'll call them working class since that's what they're being called, they're a lot of resentment against means-tested programs, I think for some very understandable reasons. These means-tested programs give subsidies to the poor and nothing to those just one notch above. Now, I know because I study such things that the subsidies to the poor are paltry, sporadic, and not very effective, but people in the middle, they don't know that. All they see is that they're hardworking Americans, they're forgotten people, and that all the Democrats can talk about, they often think, are the poor.
And all the Democrats can talk about are liberal elitist things from their perspective as well, or things that are PC, or, you know, they're worried about bathrooms and gender and that sort of thing, as you point out, as opposed to, you know, caring about these people, these white working class people.
Yeah, I think what Trump did is he connected with them at a very deep level for some not very respectable reasons and some entirely understandable reasons. Trump said to them, "You're the forgotten people. What I hear you want is jobs. I will give you jobs." Now, I don't think he's going to give them jobs because I think supply-side economics, which is basically the Republican jobs program, has been proven not to give jobs. But at least he understood what they wanted. These are a group that feel like their hold on the American dream is slipping away. And they're very, very upset about it.
And what they really want are not only the jobs, but the American dream, as I think you point out. And there's resentment against those who have perhaps come out of their own class and made it in professional ways,
absolutely,
which you point out. Yeah.
There's a lot of admiration. So there's resentment of the poor. There's admiration of the rich, as you point out, because in many ways, this is what the fantasy is to own your own small business and to be just as you are with your own small, dense social networks, not to turn into a professional, which is something extremely different, but just to be what you are with your own family and friends, just with more money. And the idea of like that you're fired, that is an amazing opportunity. I mean, this is a fantasy of an order taker to be an order giver. That's why there's so much admiration of the rich. On the other hand, professionals like you and me, Michael, we're the people who order them around every day. One blue-collar guy said,
Michael doesn't order around many people, truth be told.
Truth be told. One blue-collar guy said, talked about some college kid who doesn't know beans about my job but is perfectly willing to tell me how to do it. He didn't use the word beans, by the way. But that's I think that many in especially blue-collar working class, they feel like professionals condescend to them, professionals order them around. And this even extends to teachers, which partly explains the assault on teachers' unions. For example, in Wisconsin, there's a tremendous amount of class anger towards teachers. And I think this is one of the things that professionals really don't get. And it has very concrete political implications. For example, regulation is just another college kid who doesn't know crap about your job, who's telling you exactly how to do it. I think that doesn't mean that I am a Democrat, that we as Democrats should abandon regulation, far from it. But we should understand that regulation sets up a cross-class relationship and risks triggering class anger.
So there's really a kind of a class culture gap that you're writing about, and Joan Williams has written a book on this subject, White Working Class, Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America. She's distinguished professor of law at UC Hastings Foundation Chair and also funding director for the Center for Work-Life Law, which we've discussed with her on this program. And let's discuss what is really also resentment against government itself. I mean, it's not only maybe snotty-nosed kids who are in government who are making decisions and policies from the perspective of this class that you're writing about, but also against their interests and maybe even baleful, you know, seen as somehow evil. So there's a lot of resentment here. It's professionals. It's the governmental elite. It's it explains Trumpism. Yeah, the poor and so forth. And also, I mean, where do the unions fit in this? I mean, a lot of these are service people who presumably come out of union backgrounds and have union affiliations. And
well, the unions are the reason they used to vote Democratic.
Exactly.
Now they're, 5% of private employment is unionized. So partly what we see is the waning strength of unions. But, you know, a lot of union members this election also voted for Trump, much to the shock of the union leaders. And I think what we need to recognize is that this deep disillusionment is with Democrats as well as Republicans. A lot of people say, why are these people voting against their own self-interest? It's because they don't see a difference between Democrats and Republicans because they look at what's happened to their economic future over the last 20, 30, 40 years. And they've seen their economic future get worse and worse and worse and worse.
As you point out in your Harvard Business Review piece, that's a lot of what J.D. Vance's book was all about, Hillbillyology. Right. But there's also an important point that you make about dignity. You talk about it in terms of manly dignity, but Trump made them feel like they were winners in many ways against these losers and against people like Hillary Clinton, who was seen as, you use a lot of different words, dorkiness and arrogance. And all that talk about basket of deplorables, but also seen as being condescending.
I think that Clinton really turned this group off for a whole series of reasons. First of all, I don't think Clinton was as a talented politician. She's kind of more Al Gore than Bill Clinton. So I think she really does have at least in this election cycle, she actually did pretty well with respect to class when she was running against Obama. Different story, quite ironic. But this campaign was really class clueless in a whole series of ways. And I'll just give an example. I mean, as you know, Michael, I've worked for decades on gender issues. So I was very excited to have a woman candidate, voted for her, et cetera. But for her to focus so much on breaking the glass ceiling, well, think about it. What does the glass ceiling mean? It means the likes of me, I'm a professor, can have the same kinds of jobs that my father had. So elite women can get elite men's jobs. Why should working class people care? They don't. The men don't care. The women don't care.
Well, they should care and didn't seem to, in many instances, care about the fact that all these women came forward and charged Trump with various kinds of inappropriate behavior, and also that
sexual assault.
Sexual assault came out of not only his statement about grabbing women and so forth, but out of women's charges and so forth. It was almost really virtually dismissed.
That was the deep gender dynamic in this election. I mean, somehow it was as damaging for Hillary to have had her husband misbehave as it was for Trump to misbehave himself. What's wrong with this picture? I do think that if this had been less of a class clueless campaign, that there would have been less focus on the glass ceiling and more focus on sexual harassment, which is something that women in pink collar jobs experience all the time, with that women in blue collar jobs experience often to the level it gets literally dangerous for them. But that's a good example, I think, of how liberal elites don't understand class dynamics in this country and don't understand how class conflicts are driving people into Republicans' arms.
We want to talk about how some of that might be remedied, or at least the problems might be ameliorated. But before we do that, you've said publicly you would not support another woman candidate, even though you've just said on the air here that you certainly supported Hillary Clinton and the like.
Yeah, I didn't quite say that. I said that I don't think it would be wise to run a woman in 2020. If we ran a woman, I would definitely support her. I'm totally crazy about Elizabeth Warren. But what we just saw in the last election, I mean, Hillary Clinton won for a lot of different reasons. But it's quite clear to me that if she had been a man, she would have won because of the depth of sexism that we saw in that campaign. And I think in the United States, what the last election showed is that things are getting close to dangerous in terms of the dysfunctionality of the United States.
You talk about gender polarization as well?
No, I'm talking about politics in general, yeah. Michael. And I think that we really have to win the next election. And frankly,
we meaning Democrats?
We meaning Democrats have to win the next election. And it's just too risky to have the gender card playing so deeply against us.
Well, there's not only that. There's also a problem with leadership where, I mean, the Bernie supporters would love to see Bernie maybe come and rise in the next election. But he's obviously not necessarily going to be of an age where he could probably do that. And a realistic candidate, unlikely. Biden has said maybe he would seriously consider. He was, I think, mourning his son very deeply and didn't run the last time. But I mean, even if you were to look for a woman candidate, who would that woman candidate be?
Well, I mean, what I'm thinking
or
about—
any candidate.
Yeah, in terms of the next election is that the Democrats—and by the way, I don't think this is just about winning the presidency, so I want to talk about that in a minute. But in terms of the next time around, I think we need someone who can appeal to the white working class, or at least not turn them off. And I think the way to do that is to focus on jobs, which is something that the white working class cares very deeply about. And so do communities of color, by the way, both working class and poor. So I think so you need someone who's going to appeal to the white working class on economic issues. I think you need someone who's going to appeal to the younger voters who were not very enthused about Hillary Clinton. We saw just with the recent vote in Britain a couple days ago how important the younger voters can be if they're mobilized.
And I think Hillary Clinton took it for granted that she would probably get the support from the black working class, which she did not.
And communities of color. The Democratic candidate needs someone who communities of color will actually show up for and vote. And that also was a problem in the last election.
And how to heal that problem? I mean, it gets right at because we're talking so much about anger and resentment from this class of people, as you described them. And there it was a feeling that they were being dismissed as racist and sexist, and there was too much emphasis on political correctness, racism, sexism, and so forth. And that's what a lot of the Democratic Party, particularly under Obama's leadership and going into Hillary Clinton's, has been about.
Well, I mean, and the thing that's disturbing to me, I mean, I don't think that, I like to think that Obama and Clinton were not doing that. But certainly in some of the pushback that I have been encountering as I'm on book tour for the book, White Working Class, is how dare you stand up for these people? They're just racist, sexist, homophobic. They're beneath our notice. My attitude is that's true. Sometimes you have to think about writing off huge groups of people based on social stereotypes. That's something that is someone who has worked against social inequality my entire life, I don't think is appropriate. I think if somebody makes a racist statement, then that is not something that I'm going to sit in there and listen to. On the other hand, just saying everybody who voted for Trump is beneath our notice, I think is really inaccurate. And I think it just, again, plays into Republican hands.
Let me get your response to a comment from a listener named Paul. He writes, I grew up in rural America, worked on farms, barely met a Democrat until I went to college. The people I knew growing up were honest, decent, and if perhaps unsophisticated, not at all stupid. The people who voted for Donald Trump because they reject climate change, they are stupid. They deserve no respect from anyone who cares about science, facts, or truth in general. This is exactly what a lot of these people resent, right, isn't it?
I think that's a good example of how the Democrats are fueling class conflict in a way that undermines support for progressive causes. I've been an environmentalist since I was in law school for many, many decades. On the other hand, to frame climate change as a fight between enlightened, cosmopolitan people who understand the importance of science and pathetic, ignorant people who are climate deniers, that's basically the process of turning this into a series of insults by educated people of less educated people.
Well,
that's a recipe for class conflict. No wonder we have less support for environmental causes than we used to.
But it's also understandable when you think about the history, for example, of the response to Darwinian theory. I mean, there were people who said evolution doesn't exist. How could we come from the apes, or how could we even be connected to them? And they were seen as being small-minded or not open enough to science.
Yeah? We should be on the ground with farmers who are seeing the climate change in the way that are driving down their yields, making them change crops. Environmentalists should be on the ground with people who care a lot about hunting and fishing, talking about pollution, talking about the impact of climate change on the ground. This is the way to talk about climate change in a class-respectful way, rather than just insulting people because they don't have the same education level that you do.
As long as we're talking about agrarian and rural America, I wanted to bring in something from the Wall Street Journal, which does some analysis which says that rural America is the new inner city. Rural counties now rank worst in terms of decline. And not only talking about necessarily poverty, but just over the past recent history, they've surpassed big cities, they've surpassed suburbs, they've surpassed median or small metro areas in terms of not only poverty, but teen births and college attainment and the kinds of things that really bear down on a lot of your analysis, as well as divorce and early death and so forth. I mean, they're sort of the ignored Americans here, aren't they?
Or as Trump said, the forgotten people Would you be agreeing with him, Michael? I agree with him too. I think they're not the only guy with a billionaire silver spoon
to talk about forgotten people.
They're not the only forgotten people. I think people of color are still forgotten, and there's a long history of forgetting them. But that doesn't mean these are not forgotten people too. And I think that the real challenge, I think, for progressives and for Democrats is I think Trump is an important issue, but in some ways he's a symptom. He's a symptom of the fact that the Democratic Party for decades has depended on the blue coasts, which always vote Democratic, and the blue dots, the cities, and college towns.
And the blue collars that they don't have anymore.
Well, no. The blue dots are now the cities and the college towns, and the ocean of red in between. The ocean of red in between is just... it's disrespectful, number one, but it's also just poor strategy because the oceans of red matter in the Electoral College. Even more important, they matter for the House of Representatives. We just had a president who I deeply admire, Barack Obama, who could accomplish almost nothing permanent because he didn't have the House. The oceans of red also include the Republican hold on the states. There are only 16 Democratic governors. Two-thirds of partisan state legislative houses are held by Republicans. This blue dot, blue coast strategy with oceans of red in between is not working for Democrats, and it's not working for progressives.
And Democrats and progressives just don't get it. They don't speak to or really address those
people.
Well,
if we talk to these people as stupid, toothless climate deniers, I don't think we're taking things in the right direction.
Again, our guest is Joan Williams, and let me just say that you can become involved in this program. And before I tell you how you can do that, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has just ruled to maintain the injunction on President Trump's travel ban. News just coming across the transom here. But you can also come across our transom. That is, you can join us live and interactively. And let me tell you a number of ways to do that. You can also begin by calling us. In fact, we welcome your involvement in the conversation, any questions or comments you might have. The toll-free number, which is available to you right now, is 866-733-6786. Please feel free to join the program. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. Or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post questions or comments there at kqed.org/forum and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. One of the things that Joan Williams brings up, which I think is vitally important, is, the police. And it's a kind of a defense of the police, but largely from the perspective, I mean, obviously you're not defending police misconduct or police violence or police behavior in a racial context when it's inappropriate. Or violent, but you're saying a lot of the police officers are from this class that you're writing about. They're children of that class, and it means a good job and a good pension to them and so forth. They've been demonized, a lot of them. I mean, even the good cops have been demonized.
I think it's a complicated issue. I mean, first of all, should Black Lives Matter do something different? I think they should. They've been very effective. They should continue doing what they're doing. On the other hand, it is true that the way we've been talking about police violence has driven a lot of people into the Trump camp. So I've thought a lot about how we could talk about police violence against communities of color in a different way that wouldn't have that unintended effect.
Hold that thought, because I want to find out what you're thinking of along those lines. But we're coming up on a break, and we're going to go to your calls and your emails as well when we return. A reminder, we're talking to Joan Williams, and she's Distinguished Professor of Law at UC Hastings and also the author of White Working Class, Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America, talking about the misconceptions about the white working class. And we'll hear from you when we return. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with UC Berkeley Law Professor Joan Williams about her new book, White Working Class, Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America. And as I was saying off air, this is often described, that is, class conflict in America as America's dirty secret. But this is also a lot about divisions in terms of who were regarded as elites or who were seen as being in power and professionals and the poor. And so it goes. A lot of fractures and a lot of divisions and a lot of resentment and things that ought to be of concern to most concerned Americans. I mentioned police before we went to the break, and again, you can join us and we'll go to your calls and emails in just a moment. But I want to get back to Professor Williams' notion of what can be done about the attitude toward police, especially given the fact that many of them come directly from this class that you're writing about.
That's right. I wanted to mention
with communities of color you were talking about
absolutely.
Specifically.
Yeah, my husband's at Berkeley. I'm at proudly at UC Hastings, just to clarify.
What did I say UC Berkeley?
You said UC Berkeley. But I think, I mean, it's
apologies to you and your husband.
There you go. I think it's important to realize there's been racism in policing since policing was invented, and I totally understand that. On the other hand, I've been thinking a lot about how we can talk about a situation, for example, where a citizen who was running away gets shot in the back. How do we talk about that situation? And I think what we say is...
With fury often.
Yeah, yeah. I think what we say is, you know, it's really hard to be police. You have to have nerves of steel. You have to have nerves of steel in a context where you feel personally threatened. And that's a really hard job. And Michael, I couldn't do it. We need people who can do it. We need people who are just that cool-headed and just have just that those kinds of nerves of steel. And if you have police who are shooting people who present no threat to them in that way or no credible threat, they need to have waited and run it through their head. And we understand that's more dangerous. And that's just how much I admire the police.
Well, they do have protocols that they're supposed to follow.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Well, there is that too, right? But I think we need to basically talk about policing in a respectful way, respect the fact that it's very hard to do, and to say all we're asking you to do is a really good job of policing, which is this is not an example of.
Let's go to our callers, and let's begin with Carrie. Carrie, join us. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to say I agree with everything that Professor Williams has said so far, but my impression in the last election cycle was that Hillary was trying to speak honestly about jobs and tell people truthfully that, well, the jobs of the past aren't coming back and we need to prepare people for change, whereas Trump was playing into the nostalgia and the desire to be stuck in the shroud of the familiar, which appealed to the working class more. And I wanted to know from your guest how she thinks we can get past that and speak to people truthfully in a way that also will appeal to them and get them to, buy into the fact that change is with us.
That's a good question. Joan Williams.
What a beautiful phrase, the shroud of the familiar. One of the things to remember is that although elites tend to really, really value change, they see it as an increase in opportunity, the white working class values continuity. But here, we can't offer them complete continuity because you're right. A lot of these jobs are going to be new jobs. So I think what we say is we need a new education to employment system where you'll be able to go to your local community college and go through a certificate program that will give you exactly the skills you need for a job in your local area. And you'll be able to go at a modest price and a family-friendly schedule, and you'll be able to go back there to the same community college that has worked with a different employer when that old job disappears and you need to retrain for a new job. And so I think it's really important for Democrats to say, Republicans are about jobs. We're also about jobs. They're offering you fake jobs. We're offering you real 21st century jobs.
A good example of what the caller raised was coal mining, you know, where Hillary Clinton said, we're going to have to find newer jobs having to do with alternative energy and the like. We can't go on with this coal mining to the degree we have been. And Trump wants to say, you know, we're going to make America 1950 again somehow.
I think there's also a regional insensitivity. I mean, you know, okay, don't do coal mining, do green jobs. Well, the green jobs are in California. These people are
They're not in West Virginia. That's right. And they're not in coal mining states. Exactly right. But let's get to – I want to get to some more calls and emails here. There are lots of them. I just want to get to what you think is prescriptive in all this. So what do you think can be done to improve understanding between these groups? Because there really is a
– I think, number
chasm.
One, we have to stop the insults. I mean, I talk about Homer Simpson. That's a caricature of a blue-collar guy, is dim-witted, flabby fat. Pensatucky from Orange is the New Black is kind of a caricature of a coarse, brutish, ugly peasant. We have to stop the insults. That's number one. Number two, I think we need more PC, not less PC. PC means that it's a very important and polite company to talk respectfully of the LGBTQ community of persons of color. I think it should be equally important in polite company to talk respectfully of the white working class. And then the third thing is I think we need to start talking about jobs and build what Martin Luther King died trying to create, which is an interracial coalition. Martin Luther King said, dignity, equality means dignity, and dignity means a paycheck that lasts through the week. That is something that Democrats can believe in.
We'll go to more of your calls, and let's go next to Tim. Tim, join us. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have to take exception with everything that the author is speaking about. And I'm part of the, as you would call, white working class. I'm a 46-year-old white male. And the difference that I see and is that the Donald Trump voters have done nothing to educate themselves. And you don't have to go back to school to educate yourself. You just have to turn on the radio. How about listening to Science Friday once every Friday? How about listening to NPR? You know, I have a job where I get to listen to my radio, but so do a lot of other people, and they just turn on Fox News or an AM station and like Rush Limbaugh, and they just get spoon-fed their opinions instead of making their own judgments. And it's really simple to do, except America has become lazy, not lazy physically, but lazy mentally. And, you know, Hillary Clinton did not go far enough, in my opinion, of calling people who are like me baskets of deplorables, because we've given in to the right, and the line keeps getting pushed more and more to the right. And what we would have called centrist 20 years ago is now considered Republican, and it makes no sense. We're getting pushed and pushed more and more, and the Republican line gets pushed further and further towards the left, and I really resent that, and I really take exception to this whole conversation. We need to go harder. We need to go faster. And we should have voted for Bernie Sanders.
That's him. Thank you for weighing in. Let me get a response from Professor Williams. Joan Williams?
I completely agree with you that politics in the United States, and for that matter abroad too, has gone farther and farther and farther to the right. What accounts for most of that, studies show, is what's called cultural voting. And the cultural voting is really class conflict expressed through cultural differences. So I applaud our listener. He sounds like he comes from a white working class context and is very clued into NPR, which is kind of considered liberal. And, you know, if the entire working class were like him, then I think we should completely keep on keeping on. But it isn't. And we have to figure out whether we're going to meet people respectfully where they are and offer them something that genuinely responds to their concerns rather than talking down to them.
And let me thank Tim for the call. We'll go to more calls in just a moment. I want to go to a question posed by Jake in an email. He says, my main concern with Hillary and the Democrats is that they have made globalism an excuse to use federal money, U.S. jobs, and U.S. resources as another form of demagogic action and promises made to other nations. As a white working class person, I also would like to know why that point of view is seen as xenophobic and ignorant.
I think this is something I've just been living in Europe for a few months, and there is a real clash between sort of the liberal cosmopolitan globalist viewpoint and the very rooted viewpoint of many people who are not college graduates. And I think the way we've talked about this viewpoint is to say we're enlightened globalists, and then these other people are nativist, ignorant.
American first patriots, though, is the way they see themselves, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of us believe that we should put America first on the left as well as the right. For example, why are we building bridges in every foreign country but our own? So I do think that there's I think that to the extent that America first is used as a screen for racism, I think many of us would run in the other direction. But I think there's some elements there that that deserve further attention and respect.
But, you know, the whole argument about climate change and really the United States bailing out of Paris and so forth, a lot of the Trump supporters saw that as just a matter of globalism, that the United States was picking up a lot of the taxpayer money to pay for things where other countries were concerned. And NATO is the same thing. A lot of the Trump supporters say, well, you know, NATO, this money is not being paid. They're not paying their dues. They're not paying their proper share and so forth. So it comes down to America getting the short end, and America shouldn't get the short end from their perspective.
Well, I think from the point, a lot of this stems back to regional differences. Elites have global, national or global networks. We go to college, we meet people from all over, we know people all over. We can get a job in London as easily as San Francisco. That's not true of people who aren't elites. They are very tied to where they grew up. Their networks are very dense and local. They do not want to move. One of the reasons they don't want to move is because how would they get childcare? They have to get a new job that's not only as good as their old job, it's so much better that now they're going to have to pay for childcare. How are they going to take care of grandma? That staying local protects non-elites from their disadvantaged market position in a way I think that all of us who are celebrating globalism do not understand. I also think that globalism often has been inattentive to distribution of the benefits and the burdens of globalism. Globalism has been awesome for me, Michael, but it's been really awful for Youngstown, Ohio, Troy, New York, and that's not something that progressive elites have paid much attention to.
Well, here's Stephen, who says, at first you define class based on income, but in hearing you talk about it, it seems that it's really based more on education. Most professionals and white-collar workers that I know fall within the same income range that you used to define the working class.
The technical definition is that the elites are defined as the top 15 to 20% of Americans, so long as they have at least one college graduate in their household. Then the middle includes people who are within that middle 53% plus more affluent people who are not college graduates. So I would say, you know, there's some jobs, for example, librarian, teacher, that have middle-class incomes, but they're high human capital jobs. But a lot of professional managerial families are each person is making like $75,000, or there's one $50,000 and one $100,000. Those really are in the top 15-20% of Americans.
Let me read a comment by Lawrence, who writes, as a lifelong Democrat, I have long been appalled by the ways that Democrats have written off and offended the largest voting bloc, working class and rural whites, by calling them racist, xenophobes, homophobes, sexists, etc., simply because they do not always regurgitate progressive orthodoxy. Progressives who would never dream of offending a foreign culture dismiss and deplore blue-collar white American culture. Let me bring more of your calls on. We go to Walter. Walter, you're on.
Oh, okay. I think that the explanation that economic disparity and class, like I would say, in the, you know, traditional class in Marxist sense, economic class, it would explain the preferences of the mid of the heartland and particularly the southern states to prefer the Republican Party. I don't think that's the explanation. If you go back to 65 and 64, I don't know if you remember Johnson I can't remember the exact words, but he said, look, I'm going to sign the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. And he says, I know it's going to cost the Democratic Party a generation or two. And that's exactly what happened, because Johnson understood that there's a racial caste psychology that goes back hundreds of years from the colonial times, where people prefer to make political preferences not on the basis of just class in the classic sense, but it's racial psychology.
Yeah, Walter, you've got a lousy phone connection with you. I'm sorry to say you keep kind of going in and out and everything, but I think I get the gist of what you're bringing up here, and it's important. And let me go to Professor Williams on this. I mean, where do we sort of make the divide between race and class in your judgment?
I think there are racial dynamics going on, but they're not the only dynamics going on. For example, I was on Capitol Hill last week talking to one representative who was talking about there was an 18% swing in her vote between the Obama election and the Trump election. 18% of Obama voters voted for Trump. So I think to say all that's going on is racism here is not accurate. I also think that if you don't address legitimate economic concerns, then we saw in Weimar Germany, we see all over, they get very ugly. And if you do address those legitimate economic concerns, then what I would expect to see is less of a focus on some of these really, really scary manifestations that we're seeing now.
Well, let me thank Walter for the call, and let me go right to another caller, and that's Ron. Ron, join us.
Good morning.
Hi.
So I'm sort of in agreement with the professor's thesis regarding sort of where the Democrats have gone wrong, but I'm resigned to the fact that the two parties they're not enough to represent people. Most of us, there's a larger block of people who are independent, third party, and unaffiliated than there are either Democrats or Republicans. It wouldn't bother me to see the Democrats split into a classically liberal party, which would be sort of libertarian left, and a progressive party, because the Republicans have been making hay off of sort of neoliberalism anyway. That's the gap. That's what's missing.
All right. Let me thank you for that comment. In fact, it dovetails with the question from Ben, who says, can you describe the difference between a liberal and a progressive, and is there a difference in how the two groups approach the white working class?
I don't want to go further towards driving wedges within the Democratic Party. What I really want to focus on is those oceans of red that Democrats have ignored for decades.
Including Hillary Clinton not campaigning in the Rust Belt.
Absolutely. I think that we could win back a lot of those voters if we talked about good jobs for real Americans. And the good blue-collar jobs that require, by the way, a lot of technical skills now that need to be taught at local community colleges, not through a four-year college degree, but through a certificate program that's designed to give people exactly the skills that is needed for a local industry. That's what we really need to be talking about, to provide good jobs not only for white working-class Americans, but for working-class Americans of color and low-income Americans. We need to use that exact same new education-to-employment strategy to upskill a lot of minimum-wage jobs, which now, even if you're working full-time, which you often aren't, you can hardly feed a family off of.
And again, we're talking to UC Hastings Law Professor Joan Williams about her new book, which is called White Working Class, Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America. And a listener writes, I grew up in the South and Midwest. I've lost a good bit of my Southern accent, but I haven't lost my sensitivity to remarks about Southerners. Most members of my family are in South Carolina. Does that make some people feel sorry for me? Everybody in my family has been to college, and many have advanced degrees, several in the sciences. We're not only the only folks in the South who understand climate problems, but it's more of a battle for us when people in other parts of the country dismiss us. And there is a kind of prejudice against Southerners, and especially Southern rural folks, and sort of categorizing them, siloizing them, I'll make up a word that doesn't exist, you know, as being impoverished somehow.
I think that's really true. One of the things I've heard from hundreds of people since I wrote the initial Harvard Business Review essay on election eve and through the book, White Working Class. And a lot of them are what I call class migrants. There are people who were born in blue-collar context who are now professionals. A lot of them actually are computer engineers. There are a lot of class migrants among computer engineers. And many class migrants really love this book because they say, yes, this is what I've been trying to explain to the people around me. The people who I grew up with, they're not articulate. They don't use talk in the same ways as the elites do, but they're equally intelligent and they're equally thoughtful. And thank you for saying that.
And here's the thing I think that we're getting at in what you've just said in a number of your comments. These are people who have, you know, a strong sense of wanting dignity and wanting respect like any other human beings. And why they say, because I've heard them say it, people from that class, why is it you can make you can't make a joke about, you know, people of color? You can't make a joke about immigrants, but you can make jokes about us.
Well, and there's
or ridicule us.
There's a common form
demean
of fraternity
us,
party called a white trash bash. As I say, I think that if we included class insults within PC of like you should not go there, I think that that would take a lot of the wind out of sails of people like Rush Limbaugh.
Well, I mentioned J.D. Vance. You know, just the word hillbilly is a really pejorative,
absolutely,
derogatory word. Yet it's okay to use, I guess, especially among those who come from that background.
Yeah. I mean, Michael, the other thing I think is really important, because this is something that Democrats did wrong during the election, and in my opinion, they're still doing wrong. Just doing nothing but attacking Trump, attacking Trump, attacking Trump, attacking Trump. The reason that many people voted for Trump is, to quote an Ohio voter, we voted with our middle finger. They felt that Trump was just drove the elites nuts. And that's what they loved about Trump. So if we keep attacking Trump, that just makes them more deeply bonded to Trump. That is just a stupid strategy.
Well, it's also strange, though, to many people, even from that background who wanted to give Trump the middle finger and everything, that he's allied himself with so many, well, not only generals, but Goldman Sachs type people. In other words,
absolutely,
elites, this is a swamp that they thought he was going to drain.
Well, so we should be talking about that. We should be talking about that in a very concrete way, not just saying this guy is a buffoon, this guy is tricking you, this guy is a joker. Those are the kinds of attacks which I think are very unhelpful.
And we go to Kathy is our next caller from Esparto, California. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My question is a little bit off topic from this in the sense that do we need to perhaps reevaluate what the American dream is? I'm a teacher. I'm definitely at the low end of the working class income level. I live in an extremely rural area. And I'm wondering if we have created expectations of our population of increased standard of living and increased ability to always be better that are not particularly realistic.
I think you're right. But one person wrote me, you know, all of these people want, she was talking about Trump voters, is a modest three-bedroom cinder block house. She said, the reason that we are where we are today is that they're losing those houses. So, you know, I think, is consumerism a real problem? Do we maybe have unrealistic expectations?
They're not only able to buy houses. In many instances, they're not seeing any kind of wage earning go up. Even those who like the jobs that they're doing.
Yeah. And what's happening, of course, is that a very small business elite is pocketing the increases in productivity and pocketing the more and more of the value of the work that working class people create.
But as you said,
why are we talking about that?
Where's the resentment for Trump on that? I mean, who stiffed a lot of workers and who obviously,
you know,
I mean, I'm not
Michael,
sure I understand where that resentment is.
You know, if
he's rich, so he's okay.
Well,
I guess.
Not only that, Trump literally stiffed a lot of blue collar guys who worked on his buildings.
Absolutely.
And drove some into bankruptcy. Did you ever see those people at Clinton rallies? Maybe I missed them. I didn't.
Here's Danny who writes, I had to turn off the program because I was getting too upset. After years of Savage Nation, Rush Limbaugh, Hannity, and other hate mongers aiming their hate at liberals like me, I'm supposed to be sensitive to their concerns? Not one bit. If their feelings are hurt and they feel resentment because everything is not going their way, tough luck.
Well, all I would say is if you're happy with the direction of American politics, then go off into a corner and nurse your hurt feelings. I think it's time for someone to put a stop to the class conflict that has driven us to this very unhappy place.
Next caller, Shannon, thank you for waiting. Join us on Forum.
Yeah, hi. You know, the thing that struck me the most about what you're saying is the let's quit labeling everybody with such a broad brush. As you were talking, I was thinking about my dad, who died many years ago, but lifelong Republican, you know, advanced degrees, and a member of Wild Birds Unlimited, which is a huge environmental group made up of hunters. You know, we had guns in our house because he was a hunter, and he did all this environmental work through that organization. You know, when people start bad-mouthing Republicans, I just talk about my dad, who was, you know, an environmentalist and a Republican, and, you know, literally working in his, when he wasn't at work. And I grew up, by the way, in a college town surrounded by ranch land in eastern Washington.
Important point anyway. You're making, Shannon, and thank you for it. I don't think Professor Williams or most of us would want to be having wholesale indictments against Republicans here. There's enough partisan divide. But here's a pushback on from a listener named Carol about West Virginia. She said, please don't let people from California speak about West Virginia in such a cavalier way. And again, I don't know if anybody was intending to be cavalier. She says, there are green jobs in West Virginia, and people do understand that coal jobs, much better paid jobs, are disappearing. It would be useful to differentiate between tech jobs in California, the usefulness of which is questionable since they are heavily subsidized by venture capitalists, and green jobs, which do exist in West Virginia and are a growing part of the economy.
I think that's a good example of how it's very difficult sometimes, even if you're speaking against dismissing other people, to be heard. Sometimes you're heard as dismissing other people. So I stand corrected. I apologize.
Well, it's at the end of the program here, and we maybe have just one more question we have time for from Colin. It says, how does the middle class consider innovation in view of its dream for small business ownership, which you also alluded to? Are people from this class interested in innovation?
Depends on what you mean by innovation. I mean, I think they're certainly interested in owning their own small business. That's the dream. That's why they admire the likes of Trump. I would like to have a business just like Donald does.
Bigger question, though, is innovation the caller's raising, and I guess it depends on how you define innovation. Joan Williams, thank you so much for being with us.
I appreciate it. Always a pleasure, Michael. You actually read the book. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate your being with us. Joan Williams, again, is law professor at UC Hastings, and her new book is White Working Class, Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Tomorrow during this hour, we're going to meet Hershey Felder, an extraordinary performer, and we're also going to hear from a great band, Conbrio. Hope you'll join us for that. Thank you for joining us for this. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.